It is Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, and we are so happy to have you with us on this Sunday morning. We're talking about investing, and we have with us, as always, the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group, Bruce Helmer, and Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor, Peg Webb. Welcome to both of you. How's everybody doing?
Good morning, Susie. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning.
Hi, Peg. Hi, Susie Jones. Susie, I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. And Susie, you kind of hinted at it already. Today we're going to talk about investing. And Peg, I think most people, when they think of what you and I do or financial advisors or the financial world, their focus is on investing. And I guess I want to start by saying investing is a piece of the puzzle, but it's not the whole puzzle. What we do at Wealth Enhancement is comprehensive financial planning, and investing is an important part of planning, but there's a lot of other things that we do that we help clients with, and that financial planning is not just the investments that you make. It's the strategies that you use. It's the decisions you make about Social Security, about your insurances and your protection, about when you're going to take income and how much income you can take, when you're going to retire. So again, investing is kind of the glamorous part that people always want to talk about, but it's only one part of comprehensive financial planning. And Peg, our show today, we're calling it Investing Should Be Boring. And I think so often people want the opposite. They want investing to be exciting and glamorous. And you and I would say, no, let's keep it boring. Peg?
Yeah, it's hard to ignore it because of all the channels there is now that is in our face all day long. Like, we're supposed to know minute to minute, hour to hour what's happening. And that includes like Bloomberg and Fox News and CNBC. I mean, I'm clicking through and there's just got to be there's got to be 20 channels today, especially when you look at the internet as well. So you're right, Bruce, you know, boring should be investing, but yet today I think we want to just chit chat about, yes, it's boring, but how is it a little different than maybe picking an individual stock? So I have to lead with, you know, boring can mean just sticking with a sensible financial plan. Now, I feel like I'm a broken record here, just saying that all the time within the show, that you have to have a plan. And with a plan, you then have a couple steps that you actually just implement right away, like just generally regularly investing. And we use this term in rebalancing, and we talk about tax loss harvesting, and we talk about having a financial plan along with an estate plan. But it's, I have to laugh because decades ago, we don't have it as much anymore, Bruce, but we have people that would call us and they just want to chase that hot stock. And they want to get in early. And I remember this specifically about Yahoo. There was like this IPO, an initial public offering on Yahoo. And I got more calls about that because it was kind of the earlier days of technology and everybody wanted in at that time. Now, that company continued to do okay, but there's many companies that clients would call me and say, I want to invest in this. And I just had to repeat often of buying that one individual stock, what the odds are of, you know, making it big or trying to be a millionaire. Bruce?
Yeah, I'm going to take the baton from you, Peg. I like where you started to run with it. I agree with you that chasing the hot investment used to happen more over the years, you know, and we've built up our client base and we've coached them. I don't get as much of that. But along with that, Peg, I also occasionally got people that would come in on an annual review meeting and maybe be frustrated or disappointed with their return, but it's because they were comparing an apple to an orange. Let me explain what I mean by that. So let's start with what our goal is for our clients. Our goal, and I think this is important for all listeners to understand. I think everybody thinks they want to go get the highest return they can. That's why they want to be sexy and glamorous and chase the hot stock or the hot asset class or the newest thing. They just heard about Bitcoin or cryptocurrency or marijuana legal now. I should buy marijuana stocks. But we start with, what rate of return do you want or need to achieve your goals and objectives? And those are unique to you. What age do you want to retire? What do you want your retirement to look like? And we can calculate the return on investment that you need to achieve, get where you want to be when you want to be there. So then our recommendations or our investment advice is to try to achieve that return, but do it with the least amount of risk possible. We don't want people taking more risk than they need to take if they can get the returns that will achieve their goals with less risk. So sometimes we're telling people you should reduce market exposure or you should do various things because we want to, and as time goes on, your priorities will change, right? As when you're in your 40s and 50s, you're focused on growth. But as you get closer to retirement or you're in retirement, maybe you're less concerned about growth and you're more concerned about preservation or maybe income. You still want growth, but you don't need it as much as you did earlier in your life. So on occasion, Peg, over the years, I've sat in review meetings and someone has said, I'm going to make up numbers and take an amalgam of some of the things that have happened. But I might be sitting in a review meeting and we say, well, your return on investment last year with us was 8%. And they're like, well, but the S&P 500 made 10. How come I only made 8? And I'm like, well, you're comparing an apple to an orange. You're comparing a large cap domestic index and only large caps to a broadly diversified portfolio where we have exposure to a lot of different types of stock, things that aren't stock. And our goal was to hit an average return of 6%. We determined if we can average 6% a year, you'll never be able to spend all the money you've got. And we made 8 last year. We beat our bogey by 2, and now you're unhappy with your return. If you want me to try to beat the S&P 500, I think I can do it. But that was never our goal. You're comparing an apple to an orange. So just like chasing hot stocks or hot investments, I used to get more of that in meetings where people would compare their return to the wrong thing. But again, I've coached clients up over the years that seldom happens anymore. But I think everybody listening needs to understand that. Peg?
Well, you just reminded me of, I was talking about shows on television and on the internet and, you know, just telling us where the market is. But there's still so many subscriptions and TV kind of commercials saying that you can get rich kind of quick. And the best quote I have is from Warren Buffett. The stock market is a device for transferring money from the inpatient to the patient. So that actually is a great quote from him, because I find in my career, there was just these people, you know, clients that would want to try to make the most. And we know from working in this for so long that it's the methodical patient portfolio that does well over time. So just owning, you know, a broadly diversified portfolio and trying to be risk conscientious, but you feel like you understand the long term, that can be boring. But for you and I, Bruce, it's still important that there's some observations being done, you know, day to day, and I would say more month to month. And with our investment advisory department that we lean on to make these tweaks, kind of make some changes when there's trends that you could maybe predict, and, you know, that prediction actually gains a little bit more than maybe just staying static and instead. So portfolios, the best portfolios usually are kind of boring, but then adding these tweaks can ultimately gain you something over a longer period of time. Bruce?
I love that, Peg, but just to clarify, these tweaks are not based on headlines, or they should not be based on fear because we've had a market retraction. Yeah, again, I've joked about this on the show earlier this year, you know, whatever it was, 6 weeks ago, we had a big retraction. And people will sometimes say to me, boy, I bet your phone's ringing off the hook thinking the clients are calling. Well, I get very few, if any, nervous client calls, honestly, because, again, we spent a lot of time, you know, coaching these clients up. And I've teased Susie and other friends in the media about this. The phone calls I get are from the media. They want to respond or reaction to the market, you know, retraction. But that doesn't mean it's time to make changes. Again, the title of the show today, Investing Should Be Boring. So the stock market goes down, and a lot of people say, do something. The stock market's going down. We have to make changes. And maybe the boring advice that they don't want to hear is just stay the course. Just hang in there. These retractions happen. We know they will happen. And the worst thing you can do now is panic and sell when it's down, or make wholesale changes because you're frightened. So, yes, we make corrections, course corrections. We make tweaks to the portfolio. We proactively manage these portfolios. But these decisions to make changes are never inspired by fear or a big market retraction or a media headline. It's based on logic and pragmatism and thoughtfulness. Peg?
Yeah. So guess what? We're all human, though, Bruce. We're all humans. And we tend to have, you know, emotions that run high and run low, and hence why we're gainfully employed, because that's just something that's very, very difficult. And I'll give you a little story about myself. This was back in the 08, 09, and that still to my memory, that was the most dramatic time period. And in the profession that I'm in, right, I'm supposed to be not wanting to sell out or not wanting to advise my clients to sell out. I mean, it was a very dramatic time. And I want to tell this story because it's part of the human nature of somebody. I am professionally very smart about, you know, staying in, just tweaking portfolios, coaching clients on lots of other financial ideas that they can do. But when it comes to my money, I was as worried as everybody else was. Now, I'm on the radio and I can tell all the listeners this, but I had to contact, do you remember this, Bruce? I contacted you and I contacted the CEO of Wealth Enhancement Group, and I said, talk me off this ledge. I'm human. So even your financial advisor is human, but that's a good thing. That's a good thing that they can assist you to do the right thing at the right time. Bruce?
Well, and what you're talking about is really, you know, what we call behavioral finance. And I think any good advisor has to be able to put themselves in their client's position, right? Can I walk in my client's shoes? I do a lot of the same things. So the things that we're talking about, investing should be boring and have broad diversification and stay the course and make minor tweaks logically, thoughtfully. Look at, does your situation change? Does your risk tolerance change as you get older? We not only talk about these things, we do them ourselves. But to your point, Peg, we are also human. We have emotion, and we have to recognize that in a client. So a lot of times my meeting with a client might be, look, here's what I think you should do economically, but I'm not, you know, without apathy and without feelings. I understand why you're nervous, so you have to do what allows you to be able to sleep at night. And if that decision is something that I think is going to put a torpedo in your boat or sink you financially, then I'll try to talk you out of it. But if you can make this change that I think might not be in your best economic interest, but you feel better and you'll still be okay financially, then that's what you should do. And I have to recognize that I'm not a robot. I'm human, and I understand that different people have different levels of risk that they're comfortable with. And at the end of the day, it's your money, and you got to be able to sleep at night. Beck?
Yeah, and after decades of time, Bruce, I can honestly say that the most patient people, like Warren Buffett was talking about, that is the key to long-term success. Now, we're talking about the stock market and possibly jumping in and out and that kind of thing, but there's so much more than just investing. And we're talking about investing being boring, but like what do wealthy families do? A lot of people want to know. My clients say, hey, what are wealthy families doing? Well, let's define wealthy. Generally, it involves having a substantial net worth and a high income. Now, Charles Schwab did a survey back in 2024, and they said that the high net worth, the wealthy families have $2.5 million to be considered wealthy. The IRS as a whole considers annual income of $540,000 and that or more to be in that top 1%. Well, I talk about that because when we talk about what are wealthy families doing? Well, there's this thing out there called private equity. And private equity just means that these people who are wealthier can afford to buy individual stocks. I'm not a big fan of a lot of clients buying individual stocks because it's just too concentrated for the risk, you know, short-term and long-term. But they buy these individual stocks versus, say, the S&P 500, or they buy a mutual fund or an exchange-traded fund, that kind of thing. They're buying the actual stock, maybe purchasing parts of companies. A lot of the things that they do are very similar to what we do, just on a smaller scale. And $2.5 million is a lot of money. But there are thousands and millions of people out there that have a $2.5 million liquidity amount. And another thing that they invest in is real estate. So we've always had a percentage of real estate in our portfolios at Wealth Enhancement Group. Now that may be stock oriented, you know, dealing with real estate, or it might have been an individual type of real estate, you know, kind of hard asset type of investment that we would put in. Not a lot of percentage in that, but they also do, you know, very complex estate planning. They're looking more at the future. And then here's one, Bruce, is tax planning. Well, we all do tax planning. I don't care what type of income you have, you should be doing tax planning. So there's several things, Bruce, that I think that wealthy families do, but we all do it for these other clients as well, because they all need it, but more so they're able to take a little bit more risk in concentrated positions. Bruce?
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. And the other thing that I tell people all the time, Peg, is, you know, you mentioned, you know, what here's what wealthy people are doing. A lot of people want to emulate Warren Buffett. We actually have a quote from him. Warren Buffett says, "The stock market is a device for transferring money from the impatient to the patient." And his partner, Charlie Munger, said, "The big money is not in the buying and the selling, but in the waiting." So I say those as examples of what we're talking about today. But now in the same breath, I'm going to say what you just talked about, some of the things like maybe buying individual stocks or maybe doing private deals. You know, you and I and you know, other people that have the economic wherewithal maybe look at private investments, but that's not for everybody. If Warren Buffett does something and it doesn't work out for him, it's not going to change his lifestyle. It's not going to change his net worth much. He's going to be fine. But most people, if they take on a risky investment, whether it's a private deal or just individual stocks, and they pick incorrectly and it does badly, that could have a huge impact on their life when they're able to retire, whether they're able to pay their mortgage or not. So, again, wanting to do what the super wealthy do is in some ways logical to think that way, but as a practical matter, maybe you shouldn't be doing some of those things that the super wealthy do. But I'm glad you brought that up, Peg, because I do that all the time. You know, somebody will say to me, well, I read Warren Buffett said this or some other rich person's doing this. That doesn't mean that you should be doing that as my client. Peg, what else do you want to make sure we talk about? We're getting close to the end of our first set. Maybe the second half we can be all listeners. But anything else you want to hit on quickly before we take a break?
Sure. Well, wealthy families, actually, they hire help, right? They're able to feel like, I can't do this myself. I'm going to go hire professionals. Also, families keep their wealth through generations. It's very important to them. And they also try to definitely make it seem boring and not keep you up at night. And also, I would just close with this, because when your investing gets exciting, that's when mistakes are made. And you brought this up, Bruce, a little earlier, that when things are heightened like they were a couple months ago, yes, we had to have conversations with clients, and they're so happy that they just stayed in. Bruce?
Yeah, really quickly, Susie, before we go to break, I like that, Peg. Again, it seems self-serving to say it, but the people that are most financially successful do not do it alone. They hire help. They have advisors. And so I'm still dumbfounded by society as a whole, and that the majority of people think they can do this by themselves and they don't hire help. And there's a lot of reasons why they probably don't. And that's a whole nother show for another day, maybe, on picking an advisor. But that's a great point, and I'm glad you hit on that. I hadn't even thought of that. All right, Susie, let's take a break, and maybe listeners can drive the whole second half of the show.
All right. If you are listening right now and you have a question for Bruce or for Peg right now, 651-461-9226. 651-461-9226. Your calls and texts right after this. And welcome back to the second half of Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, along with Bruce Helmer and Peg Webb. We are taking your calls and your texts at 651-461-9226. 651-461-9226. Before we get to that, Bruce and Peg, did you want to recap the first half hour and then jump in, or jump right in? You tell me.
Thanks, Susie. Peg, anything else you wanted to hit on?
No, I think we got the highlights, Bruce.
Yeah, just thank you, Susie. Again, we're talking about investing, and it should be boring, but we'll take any and all financial questions. It just doesn't have to be about investing, and maybe some of the questions will lead us to some other places where maybe we could have gone or could have recapped. But let's let listeners drive it, and we'll get as many questions in this half of the show as we can.
All right, very good. The first text came in. I am 92 years old. I have a second home in the South. When I sell that home, am I allowed to open a Roth and deposit $250,000 in it? If so, can I name each of my five grandchildren as beneficiaries?
So, Peg, a couple things here on this question. The big one is, how and when can someone invest or contribute to a Roth IRA? Under what circumstances can they or can't they? Where I thought the texter was going to go, but they didn't, I thought they were going to ask a question about taxation on selling the property, and maybe I don't want to try to answer a question that they didn't ask, but that's where my brain went. I'll let you go first and talk about whatever part of that. There's a couple different avenues we can take this question.
Yeah, let's take the first question that they had. Well, really, the question they had is a second home down south. So the proceeds, maybe we have to talk about what you have to do tax-wise first. But if you have $250,000 and you sold a home which is classified as your second home, then you could actually have capital gains on that house. The way that works is you have a cost of your original purchase. You had a cost of improvements that you've made to that home. You take that value then and you subtract it from what you got through the sale. So if it's $250,000, let's take an example that you only have $100,000 into that home. You've held this for a very long time. Then you have $150,000 that would be capital gains on your income tax. When it comes to capital gains and a profit like that, the IRS is not allowing you to take that $250,000 and put it into a Roth IRA. I wish they would. That would be amazing. But no way, no how can you put that money in a Roth IRA. You can go deposit that money into a brokerage account or an IRA or in the bank. You need to just invest that as is. When it comes to Roth IRAs, there's a lot of rules and regulations around them. By the way, they've been around since 1998. But if you have ordinary income and you're below a certain, if you have ordinary income, but you're also below a certain income that you made, because that's how you can contribute. You need some income. Then the most that you can contribute is $6,000 or $7,000 if you're older than 50 years old each and every year. So in this case, it will not work to open up a Roth. And then the second part of this was, can I name five beneficiaries? Well, when you get that check for $250,000, yes, you can name five beneficiaries on that account. Sounds a little complex on a real estate transaction, but once you get that cash, it'd be easy to list five different people and the percentages that you would want to go to those five people. Bruce?
Yeah, Peg, I just want to add, and I don't know if the texter, if 250 is what he was selling the property for, he or she, or 250 was the gain, but the reason my brain went to the tax thing is I think the 250 number can be significant because if it's a real estate property which you've established residency, you can have up to $250,000 of gain and not have to pay capital gains taxes on it. And I wonder if that's what the texter was thinking. If you're a married couple and you file jointly, you each get that 250 or a total of 500,000. So if I went and bought a house for $200,000 30 years ago, and my spouse and I turn around and sell it now for 700,000, we don't have to pay any taxes on that $500,000 of capital gains. But if it's like Peg said, if it's a second property, which the texter was alluding to, I can't treat that the same way unless I established residency there, and there's certain things you have to do to establish residency. The other thing I just wanted to give clarity to, Peg, because I can tell that I, from meetings with clients and public speaking events, there's still confusion about this. The ability to contribute to a Roth IRA, as Peg said, you have to have earned income, and you can only put in $6,000, or if you're 50 or older, there's a catch-up provision, $7,000 a year. And if you make too much money, you can't participate at all. The IRS phases you out of participating to be able to make a new dollar contribution to a Roth. But then people say, well, wait a minute, I hear all the time about people putting in $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. That's a conversion or a rollover from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA. And in that circumstance, there is no income restriction. In fact, we don't want income. We want lower income because we want lower taxes. So I can convert any amount I want, and there's no income restrictions on doing the conversion. We will do the analysis for our clients and determine, it, number one, should you be doing a conversion or not? And number two, if so, how much should I do? But that's a totally different kettle of fish than a new dollar contribution, in which case you actually must have earned income, and it can't be over a certain income or you're restricted from participating, and it's only $6,000 or $7,000 a year. That I constantly, Peg, run into confusion over that issue. Last word to you, Peg?
No, I think that was great, Bruce. And the whole kettle of fish is what me actually had me listening even more so. I'm like, you know, I said, it's like a kettle of fish. And I'm a visionary. Do you remember this? I'm a visionary. So here I am. I've got this glass bowl with these fish, you know, floating around when you gave that quote. So that was good.
Yeah, 651-461-9226. Just got this one in. This is interesting, and I think a lot of people actually think about this, or at least they dream about this. A texter writes, I'm 67, soon to be 68. I recently won a couple of $100 million in the lottery because, you know, we had that happen. A bunch of Minnesota people won a bunch of dough. If you come into that kind of money, the person writes, how would you suggest I save, spend, or invest this money? And I wonder if you've had that happen, if someone won the lottery and called you up and said, hey, what do I do?
Yeah, so, Peg, I'll let you go first, but just to give a little context, I personally have never had a lottery winner call me. I have had situations where people have had a significant windfall for different circumstances, not winning the lottery. But, you know, there's countless stories, Peg and Susie and listeners, of people that have won the lottery, and it's been devastating. It's been very hurtful to their lives for various reasons. Peg, what have you ever gotten that call? And if you did, what would you advise that lottery winner?
Yeah, one of the things that that happens is that the percentage of people that would actually do this is just one in a gazillion, right? So I have not had somebody come in with a lottery, but a lot of different windfalls, and it would be more so like a big inheritance, you know, or I did have a couple that actually won the Price is Right, you know, and so number one, the first thing that comes up is, you know, is there any tax ramifications to these windfalls? And that's important because you can't necessarily create a financial plan when you have a big IOU to the IRS. And I would agree with you, Bruce, is that people who get a high mass of money that they're just not accustomed to, they blow through it. So first thing is find somebody that you trust. You know, hire a financial advisor, a comprehensive planning firm, because you have to recognize that if this does happen to you, you can change not only your life, but you can change a lot of different people's lives. You know, it might be family, it might be charities. These are the same things that we go through with our clients at Wealth Enhancement Group. It's all the same thing. These are just bigger numbers. And so when you're looking at that, I think it's really important, as I talked about legacy, and maybe there's a lot of other people involved now, because you either maybe want to gift money away because you also have estate planning that you need to think about. You might not even have a will. You may not have a trust. You may not have... you know, you probably have a huge liability to the IRS if you die suddenly. So there's so many things that you need to do. And I can't help but say, you know, to get professional help. And I think, Bruce, the people that went through and spent all their money, they didn't take that first step and create kind of a second family, if you will, these people that can help you do the most with that money, and also change other people's lives while you're doing it. Bruce?
Yeah, that's a really good answer, Peg. I'm just going to add a little bit. And it's admirable if you want to help family or you want to help charity, and I would never tell anybody not to do that. But I tell people all the time, you're my client. My responsibility is to you, and I want to make sure we take care of you first. And then if your generosity extends beyond that, that's awesome. But, you know, the title of our show today, Peg, is Investing Should Be Boring. And I can hear listeners already going, here he goes again. But to answer that the question a little more specifically, although it's still coming from 10,000 feet, a windfall of that size, whether it's an inheritance, whether it's selling a piece of property, whether it's winning the lottery, winning in Vegas, a big chunk of money like that needs to be split up into multiple time horizon investments. So you want some of it safe with no risk of principal, boring, best interest rate I can get, liquid, accessible when I need it, no risk of principal. Some of it's going to be in more aggressive things like stock or investments, funds that are exposed to stock to try to enhance return. And there's probably a third bucket somewhere in between that's diversified with exposure to stocks, bonds, real estate, commodities, gold and silver, and other precious metals. It's the same old story. Regardless of the circumstances, you want broad diversification, you want short-term money, mid-term money, long-term money. Now, the specifics and the more precision is how much in each of those categories, what specifically do we do in those categories. But that's a generic 10,000-foot investing is boring answer that's appropriate and applicable for anyone that finds themselves in that situation. But, Peg, you hit the nail on the head. Whether it's an advisor and or an attorney or some professional, that's your first couple of phone calls not your friends, not your neighbors, not your work colleagues, and say, hey, guess what? I won the lottery. Because everybody, word will get out, and everybody's going to have a handout, and everybody's going to want a chunk of it. And you got to really be careful. You have to be smart, thoughtful, and get professional guidance. Don't try to navigate those waters alone. But, yeah, I don't that's an interesting question. It's interesting that we got it, you know, on our show and not a call to you or I directly at our office, but maybe that's coming. Mm-hmm. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter writes, can you explain what a traditional Roth IRA is and how it works? I have not had one previously. Thank you.
So, Peg, the texter, I think, might even be kind of confusing two IRAs in one question. When they say traditional Roth, I think of traditional IRA as one thing and Roth IRA as a different thing. You want to talk about that?
Sure. You kind of talked a little bit more on Roth a minute ago when we were talking about the $250,000, but let's just go backwards a little bit in that if you have ordinary income and you qualify, if you will, with the provisions of income, you know, the cap, the high. So let's just take a look at it. If you're married filing jointly, you can open a Roth that particular tax year. And if you're below $236,000, well, some listeners are going to go, wow, that well, a lot of people can contribute to that. Well, there's also provisions that if you're over 50, you can add $1,000. So it's $7,000 base and then another 1,000 if you're 50 and older. So one of the reasons that you talk about these Roths is because the beauty of them is, yes, you have to take after-tax money. It's money that you've already paid tax on and deposited into a Roth account. The privilege, though, of doing that is that that money will then grow tax-free, and you'll be able to pull that money out tax-free at one point in time. Now, here's the part about a Roth that I absolutely love. No matter what age you are, that original money that you put in, let's say you're $7,000 because you're under 50, you can pull out that principal at any time. So let's say you want to go buy a house or you're in dire straits and you need some money. It's actually a provision in the Roth that you could pull out the original money that you put in and you can leave the money that grew over time in the Roth. So I like the flexibility of a Roth to be able to do that. And then I also diversify with clients and not have everything in a Roth. You may want to take advantage of some of the deferred types of IRAs too, which it's a little bit harder to put in a traditional deductible IRA because the married filing jointly on that is $126,000 or lower. And so a lot of people don't qualify, or if you have a plan at work, a lot of times you won't qualify for a regular traditional IRA. But I am a fan of both of those and a combination of those so that you have some taxable money and you in the future and you have some that's tax-free if you play your cards right and you have it over the period of time that the IRS says you have to hold it. Bruce?
Excellent, Peg. Just a couple really quick things. To get the tax-free treatment on the Roth, you have to hold it for at least 5 years or until age 59 and a half, whichever takes longer. And again, Peg said this, but just to give clarity, traditional IRA, you get a deduction for your contribution. So it's an after-tax dollar. It reduces your taxes the year that you make the contribution because it reduces your income, the amount of that contribution. If I put $7,000 in a traditional IRA, I have $7,000 less income. If I put $7,000 in a Roth, it's after tax and it doesn't reduce my taxable income in that year, but I might get tax-free treatment down the road, which a traditional IRA you do not. The other thing I wanted to add, though, Peg, really quickly, because, again, I still sense there's confusion out there on this. I have people occasionally ask me the question, I'm paraphrasing, What kind of rate of return at wealth enhancement do you get on IRAs or do you get on Roth IRAs? And for listeners, I want to provide clarity. The traditional IRA or the Roth IRA is not an investment. It's a strategy that might give you tax deduction and tax deferral, or it might give you complete tax avoidance, tax-free in the case of the Roth. But the investment is what you put in that strategy. It could be stocks, could be mutual funds, could be bonds, could be a money market account, could be gold and silver, real estate. So I can put a lot of different investments in that strategy. So I can't quote a rate of return on Roth IRAs at Wealth Enhancement because there's almost an infinite number of different investments that we can make in these Roth IRAs. So the IRA or the Roth IRA is a strategy, not the investment. Susie, I think we have time for one more.
All right, very good. 651-461-9226. A texter writes, how should we think about the benchmark return of a 60-40 portfolio?
Peg, 60-40. By that, they mean 60% of the assets are in stocks and 40% is in bonds. How do we build our benchmarks?
It's a little complex in that it just depends on how the stock market is. There's all sorts of benchmarks, and a lot of people talk about the S&P 500. You have to be careful about that, though, because your 60% that's in stocks may not be in all, you know, the large stocks, those companies. There's other benchmarks like the NASDAQ, which are smaller, a lot of tech stocks. There's the Dow, which is, you know, 30 stocks, a very concentrated portfolio. So we do we take many of those indexes to kind of come up with what you measure against. Then when it comes to bonds, it's very much the same in that there's indexes that we can follow. A little bit harder because it may be a municipal bond, a corporate bond, mortgage bond, those kinds of things. But we have ways to do it. Bruce?
Yeah, really quickly, we try to look at indexes that replicate what is in the actual 60-40 portfolio. So we look at 60% stock indices that are comparable, 40% bond indices that are comparable, and we say, what would this have returned? What did you actually get in your portfolio? And we can compare apples to apples. And, Susie, I hear the music. I know we're almost out of time.
Playing you off the stage. Hey, if you did not get your question answered, you can email it to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Or you can call 1-888-6-ADVICE. Again, I'll say it, 1-888-6-ADVICE if you want to follow up. Have a great week.